morning. You're listening to KUNV 91.5, and this is Neon Eden. I'm your host, J. Patrick Cooligan. Be sure to read my columns at LasVegasSun.com. My co-host, Tovin LaPan, is off today. We're joined today by Sun reporter Connor Shine, who covers local government. We'll round up some of the goings-on in our always colorful local governments. Connor, thanks for being here.
Howdy.
So let's start with the most interesting local government, and that's Clark County. Board of Clark County Commissioners. It's a colorful group of personalities, and it's been riven recently, despite the fact that they're all Democrats, with a lot of strife. Tell us about that.
Yeah, a lot of this comes down to sort of a disagreement the board had dating back to the beginning of the year over what to do with the future of University Medical Center. The hospital runs annual deficits of tens of millions of dollars. This year, they're looking at a hole of about $87 million. In January, the board discussed a change that would have kind of changed the way that the hospital is overseen. It would have taken some of the pressure off of commissioners and given it to an independent board. That vote split the commission 4-3, with the commissioners eventually deciding to move forward with legislation that would allow them to create an independent oversight board. That drew some protests from the three of the more liberal members of the board, Tom Collins, Chris Giunchigliani, and Lawrence Weekly. And that bill, when it came up for discussion in the assembly a couple weeks ago...
Let me stop you just for a second. What are the policy issues at stake here?
That's what they get at, is this change to UMC would be relatively minor. It would take the oversight role, which is currently with the Clark County Commission, and give it to an independent board of experts. Proponents for the bill say that they would give them more time. They know the issues better. They can maybe come up with new ideas for how to better run that hospital to make some money. The flip side of that, the opposition says changing that organization won't affect the bottom line issue, which is that the hospital does not bring in enough revenue, and because it provides so much care to uninsured or underinsured people, that payer mix is never going to work out. With those kind of small changes of, you know, shuffling the deck and changing who's in charge.
Mm-hmm. I understand there were also complaints about whether or not meetings of the board would be public.
Those are some secondary issues. Employees at the hospital, unions, argue that this is the first step toward privatizing the hospital. There is some language in the bill which did not end up passing that would have allowed the board, that independent board, to meet in private to discuss sensitive issues. They argue that because all their meetings are done in public, they can't discuss strategy or other competitive issues. Other hospitals in the area will see what they're doing and can kind of get ahead of them and makes them at a disadvantage to other local providers. So with all that kind of in there, this bill came up for discussion with the assembly. They would have had to pass it before any changes to the management of UMC could have been made. The three commissioners who opposed it in...
Which is, let me just break in. I mean, that's interesting in itself, that the county wants to change how it manages its hospital. It has to go to the legislature and beg for the ability to do so.
That's always one of those interesting dynamics between local leaders and state leaders. This one, I think, is in statute that would require the stuff governing UMC is in statute, which requires the legislature to change it. Mm-hmm. But the legislature is notoriously reluctant to get itself involved in political or local political scuffles, and unless something is unanimous, they're really unlikely to weigh in.
So the commissioners go up there, but some of them are in favor and some of them are against.
Yeah, well, the four that are in favor, the most important one is Commission Chair Steve Sisolak. He's a big supporter of, he says something needs to be done by UMC, said this was an option and the best solution on the table. The three that opposed him, they don't get along anyways. Tom Collins, Lawrence Weekly, and Chris Giunchigliani, they have their own issues with Commissioner Sisolak. But these kind of came to the front during this testimony, which it was very strange to see three commissioners testifying against a bill that was purportedly backed by the county. It was a county-endorsed bill. Mm-hmm. We had three of the top political leaders say, no, we don't support this. This is a bad idea. On the merits, there was an argument to be made there, but what made that interesting was that commissioners detoured into some personal attacks on the other commissioners on the board who voted in favor of the proposal. Tom Collins sort of made a side remark disparaging Susan Brager and Mary Beth Scow, two commissioners who had previously served on the school district. Collins argued that because the school district is in such poor shape that the opinions of Brager and Scow should be discounted.
But they were not credible.
Yeah.
Whereas Collins, of course, he's known for fiscal probity and probity of all kinds.
His role with the hospital is unclear. That was his argument. Lawrence Weekly made some got very passionate, made some biblical references. There is an implication maybe he said his words were mistaken. Depends how you take it, but there was the implication that maybe the other commissioners didn't care as much about the hospital in UMC as he and June Kiliani and Collins did. Mm-hmm. So this played out on last week. A few days later, the Assembly Committee decided not to pass the bill. The bill died. Nothing's going to happen there. I obviously wasn't there, but we've heard secondhand that that did not please Commission Chair Steve Sisolak. He was apparently very upset about this. Mm-hmm. There was some heart-to-heart.
And he probably thought that the dissension on the board persuaded legislators that they didn't want any part of this.
They said, legislators said as much. Yeah. They said if an issue's 4-3 and the board can't be unified behind something, we don't want to get involved with that. They just, mm-hmm. they'd rather not deal with it. So, yeah, it's tough when you're the leader of a board to have three members not only dissent, which is fine, but to then go publicly oppose the will of the board at, you know, to a higher agency. It's kind of like they, you know, did they end around on Sisolak, and he did not appreciate that. So apparently there were some heart-to-hearts. The commission gathered for their regular meeting, and when the bill came up during discussion of legislative items, there were some non-apology apologies. Collins said, I'm sorry, but I'm not sorry. Mm-hmm. Weekly said, I'm just passionate about this. I didn't mean to imply that you guys didn't care, but I really care about this, and that's what I was arguing about. So there was talk of moving past this. They all put on a nice face, but it obviously kind of gives light into how little some of those commissioners get along with Steve Sisolak. There's maybe some pushback. They get the sense he's maybe gearing up for a run for governor and being more politically cautious, mm-hmm. and maybe not leading that board as much as they'd like. So they've got, you know, they're all in there for at least another couple of years. The governor's race won't be until next year. So they've got a lot of time left to work with each other.
It promises to just get more interesting as his run for governor ramps up, mm-hmm. And potentially people want to sabotage that.
You have people,
especially,
you know,
if there's a credible alternative in the Democratic primary.
I'm not sure there's going to be that.
Yeah.
But Tom Collins, I don't think, would have any issues, you know, undermining, or he would feel no qualms about that.
Uh-huh.
Even though he reportedly is looking at a run for lieutenant governor, so the idea of Steve Sisolak and Tom Collins in the state house together would be quite a show.
That would be very funny. But and as the board is riven by strife and this clown show, forgive me for calling it that, there's some real important issues that they're taking up. The county continues to have fiscal problems, right?
Yeah, and UMC would probably be the biggest of those fiscal problems. They've got an $87 million deficit. At the meeting, Sisolak was very blunt, and he said either we have to raise revenues, which would be your taxes, or cut programs at UMC, which the people presumably don't want. Chris June Kiliani went as far to argue that some sort of countywide tax, whether it was property or whether it was some sort of hospital tax, be looked at, because they say we need to pay for this and there's no way around it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the biggest one. $87 million is a large part of the county's budget. It's about $1 billion budget. The final numbers on their budget haven't been released yet in terms of how short they're going to be, but they're getting pressed for more contributions from Metro Police, who's facing a budget deficit. They're getting $8 million more from the county, so they won't have any additional revenues this year to spend in other areas because it's all going to the police. There's issues with road repair. They're looking at a possible fuel tax increase to help pay for some of that. The county, they've got a lot of things that need money and not a lot of money to spread around, basically.
Uh-huh. And Sisolak's in a tough spot because if he's running for governor, he doesn't want to get tarred with the tax and spend label.
Yeah, he's really reluctant. Metro has a separate, with their budget, they have a separate request before the legislature to increase the quarter sales tax that was approved by voters almost a decade ago, but was never implemented because of the recession. Metro said that would help put more officers on the street, but Sisolak just would not vote to support that. He just was not for the tax increase at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I find it... I'm not sure I understand the rationale for his candidacy for governor. He seems to be, I mean, he's a pretty conservative guy. He's almost as good. I mean, what's the difference between him and Governor Brian Sandoval?
That's a good question. I mean, Sisolak, I think, made a lot of his bones, so to speak, taking on the unions early in his term as commission chair. He, you know, alienated a lot of people. That's not something typically that a Democratic, leader would go so heavily against, attack so much the unions, in this case the firefighters, who were later found to be kind of gaming the overtime system. But that was kind of where Sisolak...
That's where he found his place in the newspaper every day.
And he's ever since, he's been very good at making himself available to the media. He's mm-hmm. he speaks out. He speaks clearly. He's a very polished candidate, so to speak.
But it's quotable.
He's very accessible. He mm-hmm. he tries to be straight with people. But then when he gets up on the board, he's a little more controlling, and he's trying to get all the pieces lined up for that run. As far as terms as difference with Sandoval, I'm not entirely sure what those would be.
Yeah. Okay, that'll be interesting to watch going forward. So let's talk about City of Las Vegas. Things seem kind of quiet over there.
Yeah, they're a lot
dealing with their own budget issues.
They're dealing with a lot of their own budget issues. A lot of what's going on in Las Vegas is folks still around that downtown redevelopment, spending a little bit of money on grants to help businesses get started. You know, they still talk about the arena. But these past couple of weeks, one of the big things that they were given was this sort of long-term look at their financial assets, or their infrastructural assets, I should say. Their roads, your sewers, their parks, all those, the buildings, and how much money it costs to keep those. And sort of what the takeaway from was that was there's about $20 million each year that the city is not paying when it comes to those repairs. They're falling behind on those needed repairs. That's money that's only going to kind of add up over time. So they've got to deal with that. But in the short term, they're facing another, I think, something like $10 million budget shortfall. They're lucky they have some savings, some reserves that they're going to use to close that this year to avoid any employee cuts. But in any case, with those reserves, that's always a stopgap measure. Things are not coming back as fast as they would like to see for a lot of different reasons. The economy is improving, but it's not improving as fast as it crashed.
Mm-hmm.
So they're going to use $10 million in reserves this year. Hopefully, the deficit will be smaller next year, but we're not sure how they're going to be able to keep doing this on a perpetual basis. Something's going to have to change.
Right. And now, if I'm not mistaken, the clock is ticking for the city because the new city hall needs to be paid off. And I think the payments get significantly larger later in this decade.
I'm actually not familiar with that, but that was one of their last large expenditures downtown. They've got a lot of what they're doing right now is smaller projects. They've finished the Smith Center. They finished the Mob Museum. They finished City Hall. So they have to pay for all those.
Mm-hmm.
Now they're focusing instead on smaller businesses to try and fill in around that downtown area.
The financing for the City Hall, as I recall, was kind of the equivalent of the no stated income mm-hmm. loans of the subprime years.
Yeah. That was before I got here, but in their defense, the Las Vegas City Council is much more unified than the County Commission.
Yeah,
they vote much more in lockstep. They kind of get behind whoever's ward or district uh-huh. is the issue is in and vote along those lines. So it's a little more congenial.
Mm-hmm. Okay, North Las Vegas has a new mayor.
Yeah, Mayor Sherry Buck, after 4 years in office, took a beating. North Las Vegas economy obviously went way downhill. Foreclosures, unemployment, the city government is shrunk significantly. It was going to be tough for her to survive that, and unfortunately for her, she probably drew the strongest challenger of any of the incumbents in all the municipal elections this year, and former state senator John Lee. John Lee, you know, ran on this background of a businessman. Really just the not Sherry Buck. Her image was so tied to that city being, you know, on the verge of financial disaster, financial emergency, getting taken over by the state. She was always kind of in those discussions. And so when she had a strong challenger, it was going to be tough for her to win that. She lost a lot of support, too, unfortunately, from the unions who had previously been her big supporters. I think her father was a policeman. The union had supported some of her other candidates for council who agreed with her to kind of help get her some more support on that board.
They suspended contracts, right?
They declared fiscal emergency of July of last year, which allowed them to force concessions and suspend the agreed-upon contracts with their unions, which kind of ended that relationship there. So without the support of them, John Lee raised more money than Sherry Buck. So it's not really a surprise that he beat her. Maybe a surprise that he won in the primary by, I think, 15 to 20%. So he won by a significant margin, mm-hmm. just kind of going to show that voters had enough of Sherry Buck and were ready to try something different.
Or at least a few voters who showed up.
I think turnout was about 10 or 11%. I'm not sure how much John Lee's going to be able to change. A lot of those issues with North Las Vegas are structural. Their property values are way down.
Structural deficits.
They were at $30 million last year. They're at $18 million again this year, which we have no idea how they're going to close that. They say they need it from unions, and unions are not open to that.
Give anymore, yeah.
And so he's coming into still a very kind of in flux organization. He says his, you know, just putting a different face on it and being more open to the public and more engaging with people, he thinks will just start making things better on its own. North Las Vegas does have a lot of potential in terms of unused land in the area, lots of room for industrial activity if they can bring that in. Mayor Buck has had some success bringing new businesses. John Lee says he wants to do more of that, but that obviously takes a little bit of money too, and the city needs to probably recover a little bit before it can get to that point. But until it builds that tax base and isn't so reliant on its residential homes for all of its taxes, they're going to be in a tough spot.
And right, very reliant on residential taxpayers. And once the recession started, their taxes all fell because the value of their property fell. Yeah. But on the way back up, because property values are recovering, there's a cap.
That's the big issue they run into is that I think your property taxes or your total the taxes you pay can only go up about 3% a year. So even though
they went down 30%, now you can only go up 3% per year.
So it'll take 10 years to make that value up, which is the growth is there, but it's not being realized yet in taxes.
Mm-hmm.
And that's one of the many things commissioners, local government leaders talk a little bit about is removing that kind of constitutionally mandated cap on property tax. That would be a whole nother mess, and I don't think anybody has the political courage to do that.
Yeah.
But it's really hamstringing their efforts to recover.
Yeah. It just seems like North Las Vegas is like a zombie city almost. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't understand where's the light at the end of the tunnel? I don't know.
And when I hear the numbers in there, you hear different ones every day, but this idea that they've cut their city government by probably more than half now. I'm sure half the people that they had 5 or 6 years ago, they're kind of on skeleton staffs. They're closing library hours. They've talked about cutting parks or closing down recreation centers. They just don't have enough people to do all the things you expect a city to do, and they don't have the money to pay those people. And a lot of it is going to fire and police. That's a priority for those.
Overtime.
Yeah. It's a priority for those, for council members. They run on that public safety measure, and it is important to residents. But so when those are your first two priorities, and those are expensive operations to run, that leaves less for the for your parks or for your other operations.
Mm-hmm. All right, and Henderson's still not working on Fridays, and Henderson is just Henderson.
Things are always peachy down there. Yeah, don't
worry about it. All right, Connor Schein, he covers local government for Las Vegas Sun. Thanks for joining us. You're listening to KUNV 91.5. This is Neon Eden. We've been talking about local government. Next up, we're going to talk to Anjanette Damon, Sun Politics editor and reporter, to talk about the legislature. Thanks for joining us. And from Carson City, we are joined by our politics editor and reporter, Anjanette Damon. Anjanette, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So we're now, about two-thirds of the way into the session?
Yep, we're coming up on the two-thirds mark, so now they'll start getting some work done.
Right. that's always how it goes. Let's talk about, first of all, how do you think this, each session has a kind of character to it. How is this session shaped up for you?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. Of course, the beginning of it was so dominated by the drama of Assemblyman Stephen Brooks and dealing with his ouster from the legislature. That really sucked up a lot of oxygen. The other thing that's characterizing this legislature is the fact that most of the people in charge of running things are very new to it. Brand new speaker in the assembly, a majority leader, brand new majority leader in the Senate, new minority leaders as well. So it doesn't have that really organized, orchestrated, at least to some degree, feeling that past legislative sessions have had. You know, they started out saying, all right, we're going to have a very early discussion about taxes. We're very serious about funding education properly this session. But after all that early talk, we're now, you know, as you said, almost two-thirds done. We haven't seen much in the way on tax reform. The Senate's been pushing through some interesting bills. I would say maybe more interesting than the Assembly at this point. And I think the big question as we're kind of leading up to the end, hopefully, is how this is all going to come to a close. You know, what's going to be part of what is traditionally seen as the end game or the grand bargain that closes the session? whether or not the new people at the helm will be able to bring it to a successful, clean close, what's going to be won and what's going to be lost.
So set up for us what's at stake in that end game for each side.
Well, I mean, brass tacks, what's at stake is the governor's $6.5 billion general fund budget. Generally, the governor proposes the spending plan and the legislature tweaks it. You know, in the very past, before the recession hit and before Governor Jim Gibbons came to the fore, the governor pretty much got his way with the legislature, with his budget. When the recession hit, and it hit about the same time that Jim Gibbons became governor, the legislature really took on a lot of that carrying that load, mostly because at the time Governor Gibbons said he wouldn't raise taxes, and then the recession took such a hit on the budget. Taxes were necessary to keep services running and schools running. They cut a lot of money, and they also implemented some taxes. So now we're coming to the end. As usual, the Democrats have said that they want to fund education more than the governor has proposed. The Governor Sandoval has said, you know, he wants to fund education too, and any extra revenue that he's been able to find in his budget largely has gone to education, but he's not in favor of raising taxes.
Other than the taxes that are set to sunset will continue.
Right. He's extending the 2009 quote-unquote temporary tax increase. So that does put some more revenue into the budget. But kind of the grand scheme, if there is one, the contours of which really haven't become apparent, if the Democrats, in concert with the Republicans, because they do need some Republican votes, they need a two-thirds majority if they're going to pass any kind of tax reform. If there is a grand bargain to be had, we haven't seen the contours of it. We haven't heard much about what they want to do. There was early talk about a services tax. That is essentially dead at this point. There was some early talk about a corporate income tax that appears to be dead. That said, there have been some policy bills that Republicans have put forward that are still kind of percolating out there that could be part of a negotiation should there be one on taxes, things like construction defects. The bill died, but there's some vehicles that are still alive to which that could come back. There's some stuff on PERS reform. There's stuff on...
That's the public employee retirement system.
Right. There's some stuff on providing more regulatory oversight of the Water Authority in Las Vegas. These kinds of things, you know, Republicans are hoping to get through. And a lot of these bills have been forwarded on to the money committees, where they just kind of rest until the final days of the legislature when they decide to make an agreement on the budget and other matters.
So it sounds like, well, you say the contours of any final deal aren't clear, but then I feel like you just laid them out somewhat. Maybe some tax reform that would include a tax increase, if we're talking about that live entertainment tax,
mm-hmm. Well,
in exchange
that's the thing.
Some of those policies that Republicans want.
Right. When I say the contours haven't really been released, I mean by what the Democrats are going to ask for. They haven't really put a dollar figure on it. They want $300 million more in education, but they haven't really talked about what type of taxes that they want to pursue. Now, Speaker Kirkpatrick has been clear from the beginning that she wants to attack this by way of eliminating many tax abatements and tax exemptions, and she wants to change the way, as you said, the live entertainment tax is applied, and that bill will be coming out shortly. But she's being very quiet about how much money that might actually raise. She said that it's not about a dollar figure for her. It's about creating a better tax system going forward. So whether or not they're going to stay at the level of just, all right, we're going to change the LET and we're going to close some tax loopholes, whether or not Democrats in particular are going to try and push for more than that remains to be seen.
Closing loopholes can be tough business when you're going to have a lot of lobbyists who are going to defend those loopholes to the death. Right?
Every loophole has a constituency. If you're getting a break on taxes, there's a reason why that was implemented in the first place.
Right.
And so you can you can expect that those lobbyists will be fighting hard to prevent the legislature from taking them away.
Uh-huh. It could be a source of new clients for some lobbyists as well.
The Lobbying Job Protection Act, yes. We call it.
How about there have been a lot of social issues this session. Let's talk about the progress of those as they wend their way through. Tovin, why don't you take up, or you can engage Anjanette about driving privileges.
Well, I did want to ask you about the two bills I hear the most about in my coverage in terms of the Hispanic community, which is the driver's privilege bill, and then I believe Lucy Flores has taken on the issue of regulating notaries and better advertising, especially in the community where notarios can mean something totally different in the Hispanic culture. I was wondering, do those have a pretty clear path through to passage?
I think the driving privileges card definitely does. That's received bipartisan support in the Senate. There may be some objections from certain Republicans in the Assembly, but their minority is so small that Democrats can pretty much get that through if they want to. The issue of notarios, that's come up pretty much every session. I think one lawmaker or another will have a bill trying to address the fraud and the false advertising and the victimization that occurs in the Latino community because of that. And I have to say,
Could you guys clear that up for our listeners? Tell us what's happening. Like, what goes on that leads to exploitation?
Well, should I take this? So I've written about it. In terms of, in Latin America, if you say someone is a notario, which sounds a lot like notary in English, they have certain legal privileges. They can do certain things legally that... that a notary here cannot do. They can represent you in certain filings, and they can file legal paperwork that notaries here cannot do for you.
They're almost like a paralegal?
Yeah, and so they, so then when they come here and advertise as a notary, and they're only a notary by American law, they can say, well, they'll say notario, and maybe people in the Hispanic community think they have more rights than they do in terms of practicing law, and then they get them to, file immigration paperwork for them or all kinds of paperwork, and then it turns out they have no legal standing to do so or to represent these clients. So the laws, that they've brought up help regulate how you advertise, things you have to disclose to your clients, things like that.
So, Anjanette, is that going to go anywhere, maybe? Or?
Right, and I have to say, other than knowing that this issue does come up session after session, I have not read the particulars of Assemblywoman Flores's bill, and I'm not sure where that stands. My apologies.
Okay. Well, next time, could you just be better prepared
for our program? I'll take better notes.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how all this develops. And Anjanette, thanks. We hope you'll come back in a few weeks to give us another update before we get to that end game process you talked about. You've been listening to Neon Eden on KUNV 91.5. Our producer is Steven Zeller. My co-host is Tovin Lepan. I'm Patrick Kulikin. Catch you next week.